Welcome to Trilore Talk. I'm Scott Glovsky, and I'm your host for this podcast where we speak with some of the best trial lawyers in the United States. Today, we have a very special treat. We have Joshua Carton with us. Joshua is a communications consultant and a communications expert who trained in the theater and brings his theater background to help trial lawyers communicate emotionally, honestly, and effectively with juries. Joshua has been teaching lawyers as part of Trial Lawyers College for many years. He's taught the JAG Corps. He's taught in every major law school around the country and is truly a spectacular teacher and has a lot of great gifts to share with us today. And if you've never seen Joshua, I'd also recommend that you Google his name, Joshua Carton, and look at a video on YouTube of Joshua in action. So let's get started. I'm very happy to be sitting with Joshua Carton, who is a phenomenal human being who has done amazing things in the field of communication, who's done more to help lawyers authentically and genuinely communicate the truth of their cases and the truth of themselves than anyone I know. And I often embarrass Joshua by calling him the magic man, because that's my sincere characterization of the work that I've seen him do and the transformation that I've seen him create in lawyers telling their stories. So, Josh, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome. I'm nervous in front of a microphone.
Yeah, well, that makes two of us.
Yeah.
So, Josh, this is a storytelling podcast. So I know that you received a tremendous honor at a law school not long ago. And I wonder if I could ask you to talk a little bit about or tell the story that you told when you were receiving this wonderful award.
Okay. Well, they announced it the year before. It's a program at Stetson Law School. And I met the fellow who runs the place when I was teaching for the JAG Corps. And his name is Charlie Rose, and he is larger than life. He's not the journalist Charlie Rose, but I mean, he's somebody who'll say, "How's life loving you today?" and means it. Really brilliant. And he, from the time he left the military, and it was only criminal defense, that was the department, and went to Stetson. He's really had a vision, and they have, I guess, the number one trial team, and he made the place a center. The other people who had won this Lifetime Achievement Award were all people who worked in that field. There was nobody who was not an academician or part of that world. And so some of them were also trial lawyers, but certainly nobody with my background. So when they first announced it the year before, in a reaction of such graciousness, I said, no, because... I mean, I had sat at these banquets, Scott, and I, by the time you'd get it, everybody's had a lot of alcohol. And I appreciated the honor deeply. And but I see myself as such an outsider. And it's been, I mean, there were years where, somebody heard the term actor, and immediately you're a tumbler, a juggler, a clown, and you're going to teach people how to be false and theatrical, and it's the reverse I'm sure Jerry Spence's name has come up in these interviews before, and he said, good lawyers are good actors, but good acting is telling the truth. It's revealing to the audience the truth about the person whose role the actor is playing. It's what you just said. And so I know something about how to incinerate through stage fright by having a story to tell. But that story has to be about something. To have it be about me was just harrowing, the idea that I was going to stand up. And so I knew I had to do something that scared me, because otherwise it was just going to be a speech. And I'd loved sitting there with other people every year. So I had this idea. One of the things about song is that because it's extended speech, more feeling is communicated because the vowels are extended. You know, it's the difference between saying no and saying no. And so that's what song can do. And there's an exercise sometimes we'll do where somebody takes a song that has been hackneyed, that everybody knows through some version of it, whether it was defined by Springsteen or Sinatra, and learns how to re-sing it and tell an original personal truth through it. I mean, you can do that with anything like the Gettysburg Address. You know, we all, that's, it becomes cliched. But I actually believe that we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether this nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure, where you're using that language to tell a personal truth. So it hit me that I was going to sing. And what I was going to sing, I spent a long time looking for. So when they say my name and there's that nice applause and I come up and I'm standing on a dais now above where the group is, and I know I can't stay there. So I'm either going to have to go down amongst these tables or something. And so I start to lift the microphone off the lectern and it begins to screech. So everybody's laughing, and I decide I'm not going to panic. I'm going to just do this very slowly and methodically. And when I finally stopped, everybody started applauding again, which was interesting because I thought, did they think I was waiting for? No, I was just trying to pull myself together. But it also was, okay, however this is going to go, it's going to go different than I'd expected. So that was a good thing. And I waited, and I made sure that I looked people in the eye. And I saw, when I stole a glance at your notes, the discussion of eye contact and what that's about will be something you may want to talk about. And so I just waited, and then what came out of my mouth was, I believe in doing what I can, crying when I must, laughing when I choose. Hey ho, if love were all, I should be lonely. I believe that since my life began, the most I've had is just a talent to amuse. Hey ho, if love were all. And of course, as one goes about one's life, you discover that love in its way is all, but it comes to us dressed in costumes that your mother wouldn't have even let you leave the house in. So how did I get from this talent to amuse to standing here being honored by y'all? That melody and those lyrics were written by Noel Coward. And while I would not dare to presume that I had anything like his extraordinary talent, what I do know is similar was a love of language. And I had that. And when I started to, my brother had a teacher who said, "Mr. Carton, the goal is to go from life into literature and come back again." And that was a lesson that I had to learn when I started acting as a kid, which was that the script, no matter how brilliant, could not be the performance. And because I'd had to understand that, it became useful in working with trial lawyers, because all of the early training for the trial lawyer is as a writer. And any personal interpretation from the beginning in law school, you're shamed out of. We don't care how you feel. That's not what it's about. And are you getting the words right? But I'd had to learn from myself that getting the words right, I mean, nobody leaves the theater going, "My God, the way he remembered every word of that script perfectly, that's changed my life." So that was one thing. The other thing about Noel Coward is that I think he knew a lot about shame. And when I was a boy in the 50s, I had no real hand-eye coordination, so I grew up hearing myself called spaz and fairy and all these things, and I had to find something that could incinerate through that stage fright and the shame. And I came to understand that it would be a story that I had to tell because of an injustice I could not bear. I couldn't proceed unless there was something that I needed to say. Now, that could be a Neil Simon comedy, that could be Shakespeare, but I'd have to find a reason why I had to say it. So this fulcrum of actor-lawyer was something that when I got invited to work with trial lawyers was very useful, because that's the one you operate on. But all the early training is as the writer, and then what do you need to stand up and make a human connection with the people that are in front of you? The stage fright is enormous, and for good reason. Somebody's freedom or their future is in your hands. And I think law school operates on shame. So I talked about that in the talk, and then it went on from there. But I hope I'm not rambling entirely incoherently.
No, not at all. Joshua, when you work with lawyers, what is it that you're really doing?
Well, the greatest compliment, somebody said, "What does he do?" And my beloved friend who's gone now, and she taught at Cal Western, and she had all these advanced legal degrees, and she pioneered this program for textiles for Middle Eastern women using the original dyes, and brought them over and got rid of the middlemen, and one day said to me, "I got a real job at a rug store," at the same time that she's getting mad. Anyway, they asked Janine Kerper, "What is it that he does?" And she said, "Oh, he helps people pan for the gold inside themselves." Oh, I'm still grateful and blushing with that one. If you are speaking from a place deeper inside yourself than the one that's worried about making a mistake, worried about the judge not liking you, worried about being vulnerable to opposing counsel, but from a deeply human place, even if you're using the most legal language, and you are saying it to that deeper place in the listener. A lot of the other stuff takes care of itself. One tells the story better. One speaks, often tells a story in the present tense, because that's how we naturally do it. You know, you say, so Scott, what happened today? You don't say, well, I was departing the elevator. I was exiting the conveyance, at which time a prior acquaintance, no, you say, all right, I'm coming out of the elevator. The doors open. And I'm looking at this face, and I know it, but, you know, so you're speaking in a present tense, your voice has its own natural cadences and cataracts. I mean, in law school, I'll be teaching a third-year student, and they'll begin weeping, and they'll say, what's going on? Why am I crying? And I've come to see it's because for the first time they are hearing their own voice in the legal stuff. And they realize they've been buried alive. They're hearing the sound, the music, the cadences, the inflections of how they talk to their friends in the hallway. And I think a real mourning rises when they realize they've been sealed off from who they are. And they begin to weep. And then they move through it. I mean, they're not left crying. So I'm trying to help the person plug themselves back in to what they're doing. I mean, the folks I admire the most who use the law to make a better world, you're one of them. And so when you ask people, what do you do? Which, by the way, in other countries is not polite. But in this country, you're allowed to say, what do you do? And people say, oh, I'm a bookkeeper. I'm an attorney. I'm a superintendent. And one day it hit me. I didn't ask you what you are. I asked you what you do. And somebody said to me, oh, well, what is it you do? And I thought, I better think fast and true, because I hadn't thought to answer it myself, and otherwise it's going to sound like I'm being snotty. And luckily it came to me. I said, oh, I mostly rage and cower. That's what I do. And the guy said, oh, I see. I coach my kid's soccer team. So that person who's using the law to make something better, when the jurors know they are in the presence of that person, I'm not saying it solves everything, but it solves a lot. And words line up in ways that are organic and persuasive and deeply felt. And you're not thinking, oh, am I being dramatic? Oh, am I making a gesture? Oh, am I... It just can pour out. Now, there's a huge amount of preparation that's necessary to be in that place. So it's not about winging it. But it's about allowing oneself to be seen, unprotected.
How can a lawyer get there? What are the ingredients?
I'm thinking... You know, a healthy diet, exercise. I mean, how do you do it in your life? I don't mean for that to be glib. And my stomach is gurgling. Are you hearing it? Is it picking it up on the mic, I wonder?
No, I've got these big headphones on.
Oh, so you can't hear it. How do you get there?
And we can talk. You know, one of the ingredients may be...
You don't get there by imitating anybody else. That I know. You know, there are some trial consultants at the moment. And by the way, from the very beginning when I started this, the people who were trial consultants, they were jury consultants. They were about picking a jury. In the theater, which is where I came out of, you don't have control over who's in the audience. So, and the scripts that we wrote for the plays or television things I worked on, they had to be used, they had to work for an audience that you had no control over. So I was never about picking a jury, and have great respect for those who bring that knowledge. But I was starting to say that you have somebody like David Ball's work, which has been, you know, a game changer. But I will come and start working with a lawyer in a seminar, and they will say, a blank may not needlessly harm a blank. And if they do, they are responsible. And so I'm hearing David's template, but the person isn't present in what they're saying. And they're hoping that if they recite this text, it's like rubbing the magic lantern and the genie will come out. And so helping them own what they're saying is often, that takes a while. And then these words are their own. Well, that's certainly an actor's task. You know, if you see somebody reciting Hamlet, that's no good. And in fact, it's really no good if you see an actor playing Hamlet. What you have to see and be present with is a young man struggling to figure out what the hell is needed of him and what he's going to do. And then it's not Hamlet. It's the truth of this young man in this moment of his life and decision. And so how do you do it? I mean, there's sometimes very simple things like take a section of an opening that you is falling flat and simply change the name. And instead of the name of the client who you now feel a little betrayed by and pissy about, put in the name of your dearest friend. As you're preparing it, I don't mean in court. And suddenly, it's a very different score because your nervous system is hearing a cue in that proper noun of something you truly, deeply care about. So, I mean, there's techniques for helping yourself to it.
Let's talk about the physicality. I've watched you brilliantly have someone who English is their second language give an opening statement in their native language so that everyone in the audience who speaks English has no understanding of the words, but yet you require them to communicate the story in their native language. Can you talk about that?
You bet I can. So at first they'll work in the language that no one understands, which means they can't presume that saying the words communicates it. And then what we do is say, okay, now nobody understands it, but people immediately do want to participate and say, yeah, but she's so interesting now and she's so animated. You know, Diane Wiley, who's a brilliant, one of the original founders of trial consulting, says she teaches English as a second language to lawyers. So you're already speaking two languages, English and legalese. And so you take away the assumption that people saying the words is the communication. And then we add, okay, now people who are listening, you know, people in the seminar, the group, have to tell you back what you're saying or you can't go on. That's how you get permission to go forward. And then there's this usual, what? Well, they don't understand. Well, it won't work. Please. I don't want to say trust me, but please. So what will happen is the person will say, well, is this supposed to be charades? So now we have already demeaned it. We've mocked it. We've put it in quotes. I said, call it whatever you want, but until they tell you back in English. So the person begins to work with their whole being to be understood, and there is a global commitment to communicating, and not just to the broadcasting, but to the responsibility of the receiver getting it. So everything gets sharper. And people start to lean forward in their seats because they're seeing an effort, a need to be understood. And this makes them want to participate, which does not diminish when the person goes back to English. So there's all this collateral awareness of what is it that really makes jurors lean forward in their seats and care, because they're seeing a commitment not just to getting the information out, but to their getting it from the communicator. And then we flip them back into English, and sometimes the person immediately goes dead again, and everybody in the group laughs because it's obvious what's happened, which is the assumption that the words do it. And we go back and forth until the motor that is turning when they are communicating now, past the words, through the words, stays when the language shifts into the English. And then it becomes a kind of music. Now, sometimes people say, well, can we just do this with mime? Yeah, you could. And it's very eloquent. And it also simplifies it because it stops. I mean, if you can't communicate it physically, it may be it's because you are balancing on stilts of legal theory. And you're really not communicating with jurors, you're communicating with your law school professors, and it's not really what's needed. But the other thing is that you do have to speak, you do have to make sound. So by working in a foreign language, that is already going. The other thing is, and again, in law school this will happen, anybody who comes from another country, there's usually enormous trauma and struggle in the family to get here. I mean, you have a law student who's Vietnamese, and what their parents went through to get here. And so the language that they were suckled in, that they were held in, that they dreamt in, has been one that they have to hide because they have to be able to pass, to function. And so it's even more compounded, the shame release. And those students sometimes will just break down. And if you can keep it safe for them, which is my job, so that they understand that what's being released is a suppression. And then in the wake of that, really, bathed in those tears of held intimacy. When they now start speaking English, it's with a power. It's very beautiful to see.
You mentioned having a safe space. Can we talk for a moment about
yes,
that?
Yes. That's a syllable that a communications person should avoid, isn't it? You've been with me enough when I'm working that would you ask me a question about it to take us a little more specifically into it?
Sure. I recall you mentioning on one occasion just about being in a courtroom that if you like chocolate, you can take a little piece of chocolate and stick it at both ends of the jury box to...
Well, even one, and on the ground. And I recently did a program where a very experienced lawyer heard that and walked out. that was just frivolous and this is a serious business. I mean, he was profoundly offended. Was I? Yes, I was offended at his being offended because it comes from understanding what people need. I mean, there's a Supreme Court case that I got to work on that meant a great deal to me because it was the first thing from Guantanamo Bay when the president of the United States, who'd been basically crowned in the Florida decision by the Supreme Court, we were now addressing the Supreme Court to limit executive action, and could habeas corpus be suspended? And this was Hamdan versus Rumsfeld. And the lawyer who was bringing it to the Supreme Court, this is what you want, stories, right? He was not a trial lawyer, and he was a brilliant fellow. And he knew that if all we did was massage, you know, case references, the loudest sound you were going to hear in that Supreme Court chamber was Scalia, you know, opening his zipper to pee on this whole thing. And yet anything that smacked of acting would also be deadly. He was angry at those justices because of what was happening. And that anger was not going to be helpful. And it was also the beginning of my understanding that appellate work is most like voir dire in that when people talk and ask questions, it cannot be felt as an interruption, because if you were going to say the lawyer was any hint of no or I'll get to that, it doesn't work. So to really welcome that, and by the way, that's where improv and its rule of always accepting the offer proved so useful. And so I know in Seattle you have a group of lawyers who are doing professional improv, so that you're always welcoming that input, whether it's voir dire or appellate work. Anyway, he was angry, and we knew we had to find something so that would let him experience a kind of unconditional love. And I know that sounds Oprah-esque, but yeah. So he had three boys under the age of, at the time, 5. And my understanding was that he could come back from Guantanamo Bay and handle that. But if he had solo child care, calls from the White House weren't taken. The devotion to those kids. So I thought, okay, where does he know a place where no matter how much they irritate him, he doesn't react with anger, but with patience and appreciation and the desire to help. And I thought, well, it's going to be that nursery. So we chose a stuffed animal from his kids' nursery for every one of the Supreme Court justices. Not that he was hallucinating Eeyore, but he said that's exactly what he used, the animals. Actually, when I got a call and he said, I did it, I said, I was in tears. I said, I know. He said, no, the animals. Whatever. I mean, we have in us a volume of selves. And the self that is our bookmark is just that. And I was working with a lawyer the other day. And she was going through something where she was explaining that somebody was mocking her in the voir dire. And she said, you know, it froze her. She was angry. She's raised 3 kids. The last 2 are still in their teenage years. And when I started to role play that person, she would stay, even if she tried not to. You know, this was afterwards, and we were going through, slowing it down, going through it, trying to find a way to move through it where she felt safe and could handle it with an agility that she has in real life. And she was still. Well, is that okay? Was how she was ending it until I finally go, Mom, it's not fair. I hate you. And she said, well, look, you can't do it, and I'll do my best. And suddenly her eyes are sparkling because she knows herself as a mom how to ride through that. So it's not a question of being anybody other than yourself. It's finding which one of the selves you have access to, but you haven't thought about bringing it into the courtroom. So it's interesting because as I'm talking through this with you, yes, it's about a safe place, but it's also about the self you let yourself be in that place and how portable that is.
And how about making the listener feel safe? I know one of the wonderful quotes that you decorate the rooms with in which you work. One of the quotes you put up is, if the story is not about the hearer, he will not listen, by John Steinbeck.
Yeah, in East of Eden. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
No, I can't talk a little bit. I can talk for hours about that. Because it goes back to the thing about, are there magic words? And do I take this thing from what some of the great trial consultants in their books say, this script, this snippet, this approach? More and more I'm feeling, I mean, we're in a time right now that is frightening for a lot of us because the discourse has really degraded to something nasty, name-calling. And so the assumptions of some basic common agreements, it seems like we're getting more and so polarized we can't even do that. Nobody seems at the moment to be suggesting they're going to vote for somebody, but they're vehemently voting against somebody else. But when two people are communicating live and somehow they feel that the other person is unguarded and wanting to know what they think and feel and respecting it, something happens between them, and when that happens, a lot of the slogans and the cliches and the assumptions and the brittlenesses and the hostilities somehow seem like far away, because right here, right now, there's something good. In acting class, you learn that any two-person scene is ultimately either a fight scene or a love scene, or sometimes both. So when someone feels truly seen, truly heard, truly listened to, and they feel that the other person is not gaming them, it still seems possible for them both to acknowledge and appreciate their point of their place of agreement, and that in this case a juror could be enlisted to do the right thing. Now, yes, do they need to feel that that right thing is going to be beneficial to them? Yes. Do certain principles of what's being called the reptile, are they a part of it? Yes. But there's an aspect, I think, of, well, I want to say it. It's love. It's that person cares about you, and I've seen enormous things be possible when that happens. There was a lawyer recently. We were having a voir dire seminar, and I got a call. And he had been in a case, and it had to do with an accusation of child abuse. I'm going to name him. His name is John Colvin, and I'm very impressed with what he told me. He's a fine fellow. Do you know him?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay, so it has to do with an accusation of some sexual abuse, and if you work in those, you know they're harrowing, and the accusation ruins lives, even if it turns out it's not true. It's too late. So there's a very nicely dressed woman shorthand, junior league, you know, beautifully dressed, groomed hair of a certain shade of ash blonde. And she's questioned and talks. And then eventually, as the conversation moves to other potential jurors, he senses that she's sobbing. And I shouldn't be telling his story. We're going to have to check with him if this is okay or cut this. And he becomes aware of it, and he does not know what to do. But he does know what to do. And not because it's a strategy or a technique or he has permission. And what comes out of his mouth is he says to her, "I see you. How can I help?" And he opens the gate. And he says something about, "Would you like me to..." I don't even know that he finishes about talk to the judge. And he also describes a moment where he asks her to, you know, I don't even know if he does it verbally, but come. And he's going to escort her. And his hand is right behind the small of her back to help support her. She's not collapsing, but dare he touch her? Should he... And that he stops thinking about that and just gently helps. That "I see you" just thrilled me. "I see you." Oh, and he said after that, within a few moments, the Veneri panel exploded in stories and self-revelations at a level that it hadn't approached before.
That's a beautiful story.
Isn't that? You'll do one with him.
There's another quote of yours there that you put up. "The place that seems most dangerous is exactly where safety lies."
That's Barbara Cook, who was the great coloratura and soprano. It was always the silvery soprano of Barbara Cook. And she created some roles in the musical theater. And is considered a great teacher, and said that. And you're probably going to have to explain what where these quotes come from and what all that's about.
Well, please do.
You will, John. And that's just everything we're afraid of saying, that it'll damage the case, that it'll poison the jury. It doesn't. But what people sense is that you are being held back. You are holding yourself back. You are suppressing something. And, you know, things that the other side, you fear that they're going to try to use to humiliate your client, or that's a negative thing, when you own it. It doesn't take it away, but it neutralizes the negative aspect of it, and sometimes it's a very positive thing. I mean, it's like Jean Valjean. Yes, he stole a loaf of bread. Why? Because a child was hungry. And Les Mis has been quite a success. And the book, Les Miserables, and you know, kids read that in the old days in school in ways they don't now. So we're afraid that if the jury finds out that he had a conviction for theft, and yet when they find out, yes, he did. He stole a loaf of bread because a child was hungry. So now we see him as heroic and having courage. You know, and I mean, this is the great stuff that Rick Friedman's done in polarizing the case, taking what they're trying to make you afraid of having revealed. I mean, that's part of what he's doing, not the whole thing, but yeah. And I also think it's because all you have is the truth. And I think the only way you can speak with that unfettered passion is because you're not hiding anything. Yes, please, come in. which is why the idea of letting each juror, no matter how quickly, look into your eyes before you ask them to start being responsible for spoken information. Now, in order to do that, sometimes you have to spend a long time in training looking till you're not trying to flinch or get it over with or run away or get to the words. So in the training part, as you're building the muscle, people can feel, oh, well, this is so awkward. Nobody wants to be stared down. No, of course not. But we're not saying that in the end you're going to be looking at somebody that long before you talk. What you're learning how to do is be able to stand up in front of people unprotected by language or argument or training or education or personality and just be there. I mean, you remember looking into your boys' eyes when they were pre-verbal, when they were in that crib, and the glory of that, and how they weren't afraid of you, and they certainly weren't afraid of looking. Yeah.
And that seems to relate, in a way, to creating a safe space. I mean, what I referred to earlier is when you work with a group of lawyers or folks, before they walk in, you spend a tremendous amount of time writing out beautiful and meaningful quotes and
standing up on 12-foot ladders and in hotels negotiating with their catering staff who are concerned about liability and all that, yeah, so that people walk into a room where something has been made for them. It helps me with my stage fright that I've made a space. And then it came to me at one point to have them tour silently because we're asking them to take a risk. And I can't ask them to do that if I'm not going to be doing something like that. And what's riskier than asking a group of attorneys to not talk? So, and to move through that space quietly, just reading them all. And I always worry that when people have been to a seminar before, that, okay, they've done this, and the response is always no. It's not been there, done that. It's a rediscovery of what it is to be allowed to just be there and receive something and then gather in the silence and then begin with language out of already a communal experience having happened. I'm sounding so spiritual. I don't know who's talking. It's just
no. It does seem to, in some ways, all boil down to what you mentioned earlier: to love, to caring about the other person.
Yeah.
And honoring them and acknowledging them and being vulnerable, sharing unabashedly who you are.
Yeah, and that doesn't mean talking about it. It's a nonverbal. Eric Oliver says rapport is not a verbal phenomenon. You know, my father, when I was little, used to say, cliches are the encapsulated wisdom of the ages. I live by cliches. And I thought, oh, how can you say that? Yeah, I live by cliches. That's terrible. But I find I'm spending a lot of time with quotes. These quotations are wisdoms, and gathering them all. You know, people ask me to send them, I'm happy to.
Joshua, what advice do you have for our listeners out there that you know, want to get to this place where they can be open and vulnerable and communicate naturally with eye contact? What tools are there out there, or exercises, or books? What words of wisdom or advice do you have for people who want to get there?
Well, I realized there was something I was going to say before, and it was another quote, and then I lost it, which is a great acting teacher. And she said, the great moments in life, great moments on stage, like great moments in life, happen when who you are talking to suddenly becomes more real to you than what you'd come on stage thinking you needed to say. And that's true with jurors, that it's not that you abandon the script, but that in terms of priorities, who you're actually talking to is your priority. And you're bringing this information to them. And sometimes the language has to be exact and memorized. You know, you play Shakespeare, you can't change it. Can't even change a pause because the... a pause. Because the pauses bespeak, in that writing, the state of mind of the speaker. So, letting who you're talking to trump retrieving the text exactly can be done in exercise work. You have to come to a place where you are willing, in exercise work, to forget your lines and hang with the person, your partner. And there are a lot of ways we do that, you know, with shaking the hand. I mean, widely imitated, that technique. And somebody will want to dart their eyes away, retrieve a script. Oh, because standing here with another person in physical contact, not armed with acceptable language, can be harrowing. But once I've tolerated that, I realize that I can always go back to the table and get the words. But if the listener feels I'm more concerned about the words than about them, that is a primary loyalty, a primary priority. What's the word I'm looking for this? The hierarchy. And at the top of the hierarchy has to be my understanding as the attorney that I can't do it without you. So even if I've been betrayed in the past, even if I'm terrified of you, I need you. And if you sense that I see you as a necessary inconvenience, a caption, a afterthought, a postscript to all of my preparation, I am losing the one thing I need, which is that you feel that none of this can happen without you. And that is the truth of it. That's the genius of what they did. They replaced the king with the jurors. and that I am here serving this jury so they can do the right thing. It takes an enormous amount of preparation to feel free to forget your lines so they'll come to you in the moment based on who you're really talking to. And then the listener knows that it will never be reproduced the same way again for anybody else than it is being heard right now because of who I see you are. I mean, it's the magic. Oh God, I swore I'd never use that word. But the thrill of falling in love right now, right here. And whatever fears the juror came in with of being tricked or of going against certain assumptions, when we fall in love, that's when we are willing to bypass those. Because it feels like there's a truth here now I did not know I could have, and I don't want to be without you. You're going to bring me something that nobody else can. Because of how you feel about me.
That's just beautiful. Joshua, thank you so much.
Oh, we're done?
Well, we don't have to be done. We don't have to be done.
We can be done. Do you want to look down there and see if there's anything else? Did it all?
Well, I'm... this is...
This is if you ever go to one of the, you know this in the workshops, I'm throwing up before it starts, and then, 4 hours are over, but we're not done yet, are we?
What else would you like to share?
My gratitude to the extraordinary courage of trial lawyers. And... the ones who protect and the ones who risk my profound gratitude.
Well, let me echo that gratitude. Joshua, you've done more to help great lawyers, and by helping great lawyers, helping thousands of clients, thousands of people out there who needed justice or needed not to be imprisoned. And thanks to your wonderful gifts, you've made a lot of people's lives much better. And I know it's embarrassing to you, but I'm going to continue to call you the Magic Man because that's what you are. And the gifts you bring are tremendous. So on behalf of myself personally, on behalf of all of your students around the country and all of the great clients that you've helped, thank you. Thank you for joining us today for Trial Lawyer Talk. If you like the show, I'd really appreciate it if you could give us a good review on iTunes, and I'd love to get your feedback. You can reach me at www.scottglovsky.com. That's scottglovsky.com. And I'd love to hear your feedback. You can also check out the book that I published called Fighting Health Insurance Denials, A Primer for Lawyers. That's on Amazon. I put the book together based on 20 years of suing health insurance companies for denying medical care to people, and it provides a general outline of how to fight health insurance denials. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you in the next episode.